All right, diving right in, folks. Let's get into a story. Well, it's a story that's both tragic and legally fascinating. How do I put this?
Tragic and fascinating. That's a good way to sum it up.
Right. The Attica prison uprising and the case that they came out of it. Inmates of Attica v. Rockefeller.
Oh, that's a good one.
You probably heard of Attica itself, but the legal wrangling afterwards, that's where things get really interesting,
Oh,
right?
absolutely.
We're talking 1971, Attica Correctional Facility in New York. Tensions, you know, they boil over and the prison erupts in violence.
Yeah, and I think what a lot of people don't realize is that it wasn't just like some random explosion of anger. The
Right.
conditions at Attica were just horrendous. You had the overcrowding, the lack of basic sanitation, racial tensions. I mean, it was a powder keg, you know, just waiting to ignite.
And ignite it did. The retaking of the prison was brutal, and when the dust settled, 43 people, inmates and hostages, were dead. Allegations of abuse, cover-ups by state officials, I mean, just flying everywhere. Just a horrific situation.
It really was.
And it raised huge questions about accountability.
Oh, yeah.
And that's really where this legal battle begins. The inmates, understandably, wanted justice, right?
Curious.
But instead of just filing like a standard lawsuit for damages, they did something much, much bolder.
They did.
They filed a mandamus action,
Right.
inmates of Attica v. Rockefeller, to force state and federal prosecutors to actually investigate and bring criminal charges.
Wow.
Mandamus. Okay. So for those listening who aren't, you know, legal eagles like yourself, can you break that down for us a little bit?
Sure.
Because that sounds pretty intense.
Yeah, ass intense. So, think of it this way. You're waiting on a building permit from the city, right?
Okay.
They're just sitting on it. Mandamus is like going to court and saying, "Hey, look, you have a legal duty to process this, get moving."
Right.
It's not something you see every day.
No.
It's pretty rare.
So essentially, the inmates were saying, look, you prosecutors have to investigate this. It's your duty. That's a pretty gutsy move considering, you know, the power dynamics at play here.
It absolutely was. I mean, they were taking on like this core concept of prosecutorial discretion, right?
Right.
Which is this bedrock principle that prosecutors have wide, wide latitude in deciding which cases to pursue. They were basically saying, like, look, this situation is so egregious, you can't just ignore it. They wanted the court to design like an independent investigation plan, force the attorney general to prosecute the whole nine yards.
Wow, talk about aiming high. But I'm guessing probably didn't go exactly as planned, huh?
You're right, you're right. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals ultimately rejected the inmates' attempt to compel those prosecutions.
Okay.
And Judge Mansfield, who wrote the opinion, went to great lengths to explain why the court couldn't just step in and force the prosecutor's hand.
All right, so break it down for us. What were the key points in Judge Mansfield's reasoning? What made this such a tricky case?
All right, so there are a few key things going on here. First, the inmates were relying on a very specific statute, 42 USC section 1987, which says federal attorneys shall prosecute civil rights violations.
Okay.
They argued that that language, shall prosecute, took away all discretion, making prosecution mandatory.
So their argument was shall means must, no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Exactly.
All right.
But the court said, hold on, not so fast.
Right.
They looked at the entire statute, its history, and you know, and all the potential consequences of like a really rigid interpretation.
Yeah.
They concluded that Congress didn't intend to completely eliminate prosecutorial discretion with just that one word.
So nuance and context matter,
They do.
even in legal language.
Absolutely.
Makes sense.
The second point Judge Mansfield raised was all about federalism,
Right.
that balance of power between the state and federal governments. He argued that ordering state prosecutors to act would be like a massive intrusion on state sovereignty.
Right.
He even quoted a Supreme Court case saying, you know, federal courts can't dictate state criminal processes.
Okay. Yeah, I could see how that would be a problem. You can't have federal courts just micromanaging every local prosecutor's office.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And the third point was practical. Judge Mansfield basically said, judges aren't detectives.
Right.
We're not equipped to run criminal investigations.
Right.
You know, imagine a judge trying to oversee every subpoena, every witness interview.
Yeah.
It would be a logistical nightmare.
Yeah. Talk about a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
So the court said no to forcing prosecutions. Was that the end of the road for the inmates?
Not quite, not quite. And this is where things get even more interesting. The court, they might have shut down that idea of ordering prosecutions for the past, right?
Okay.
But they left this tiny little door open, just a crack, for a different kind of legal action.
Ooh, a plot twist. I love it when legal cases get twisty. Tell me more.
All right, so the court said that while they couldn't, you know, compel prosecutions for what had already happened at Attica, they didn't completely shut down the inmates' quest for some kind of justice. They said the inmates could still potentially seek something called injunctive relief to try and prevent future abuses.
Oh, injunctive relief. Now, remind me what that is again. It sounds familiar, but...
Sure, sure. So injunctive relief is basically a court order that tells someone, in this case, you know, prison officials, you can't do that anymore.
Right.
Right. It's about stopping specific actions, right, to prevent future harm. So in the Attica case, the inmates could potentially get a court order that would force the prison to change its policies or practices, right,
right,
to prevent future brutality or mistreatment.
So it's not about punishing past wrongdoing. It's about trying to prevent it from happening again.
Exactly.
That's a fascinating distinction.
It is. It is. And this particular legal strategy has become known as, get this, the Attica two-step. No looking back, no ordering prosecutions, but there's this potential path to get some forward-looking protection against, like, that systemic abuse. Pretty clever, huh?
Very clever. So even though the court didn't give the inmates everything they wanted, it still opened this door, this possibility for some measure of accountability and change.
Exactly. And that's why inmates of Attica v. Rockefeller, you know, it's still so relevant today, almost 50 years later. It set this precedent in this really tricky area of prosecutorial discretion, especially when you're talking about, you know, allegations of abuse of power.
Yeah, the Attica case's legacy, it's especially relevant today, right?
Mm.
With all this focus on police brutality and holding law enforcement accountable, it really highlights how difficult it is to challenge prosecutorial discretion, even when there are serious, serious concerns about the potential for abuse of power.
You hit the nail on the head, and this case has had these ripple effects, you know, in so many areas of the law. Oh, yeah. For starters, it's become much, much harder for everyday citizens to try to force prosecutors to bring charges. I mean, if the Attica inmates couldn't compel prosecutions for what happened there, I mean, come on.
Right.
That sets a really high bar for anyone else trying to do the same thing.
So it's not enough for someone to just say, hey, I think a crime happened, go prosecute it.
Right, right.
There needs to be like a strong legal basis and a really compelling reason for a court to step in and interfere with a prosecutor's decision making.
Right. And inmates of Attica really helped to solidify that legal framework, you know?
Yeah.
There's this later Supreme Court case, Linda R.S. v. Richard D., that really drives this point home.
Okay.
So this mother tried to force a district attorney to prosecute her ex-husband for not paying child support.
Hmm. Interesting. So even though not paying child support is clearly against the law, the court still sided with the idea of prosecutorial discretion.
They did.
Wow.
And they cited inmates of Attica as precedent. They emphasized that separation of powers idea. The courts shouldn't be meddling in the executive branch's business, especially when it comes to, you know, prosecutorial decisions. They basically said the courts shouldn't be flooded with, you know, people just trying to dictate which cases get prosecuted.
I get it. It would be chaos if anyone could just walk into court and tell prosecutors what to do.
Exactly. Now, another area where inmates of Attica had a lasting impact is how people try to use Section 1987 to compel federal prosecution of civil rights violations.
Right, right.
Remember, that was the statute the Attica inmates were relying on.
Right.
And the court basically said, nice try, but no.
So using Section 1987 to try to force prosecutions is basically like a dead end.
It's incredibly rare for it to be successful. I mean, since inmates of Attica in 1973, there's only been a handful of cases where Section 1987 was successfully used to force federal prosecution.
Wow. That really shows you, you know, the weight of that precedent.
Yeah.
It basically shut down a whole avenue for legal action.
It did. It did. And then there's this other important aspect of the Attica case. The whole issue of class action lawsuits, especially those brought by prisoners.
Oh, right, right. Mm-hmm. The inmates were trying to bring their case as a class action,
right? Mm-hmm.
Representing, you know, all the inmates impacted by the uprising.
Right.
What happened with that?
Well, the Second Circuit, they actually kicked that question back down to the district court for more consideration. But even that move, it just sparked decades of debate about the complexities of prisoner class actions.
Prisoner litigation, that's a whole other deep dive waiting to happen.
It is, it is. And, you know, Inmates of Attica, it kind of indirectly contributed to some of the legal battles that ultimately led to the Prison Litigation Reform Act.
Okay.
The PLRA.
The PLRA.
Which puts some pretty big restrictions on lawsuits filed by prisoners.
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves. PLRA, topic for another day. But it is fascinating to see how all these legal threads all connect, right? So far, we've got limits on private prosecutions, you know, a weakened Section 1987 strategy, ripple effects in the world of prisoner class actions. Anything else?
Well, I think it's worth thinking about how the Attica case might be decided differently today.
Okay.
Given some of the more recent decisions from the Supreme Court.
Ooh. Intrigue at the Supreme Court level. I'm all ears. Give me the details.
Okay, so there's this case, Trump v. Vance from 2020.
Okay.
It really reinforced that whole prosecutorial independence thing we were talking about before. It involved this grand jury subpoena for President Trump's financial records.
Right.
And the Supreme Court basically said, look, presidents, they're not above the law.
Okay.
They can be investigated.
Okay.
But they also really stressed the importance of protecting prosecutors from, you know, political pressure.
So even a president can't just, like, boss prosecutors around and be like, you got to go after this person or, you know, sure, drop this case. Nope. Prosecutorial discretion. Powerful stuff, at least for now.
Okay, so how does Trump v. Vance potentially change the game for a case like Inmates of Attica? Would the outcome be different today?
Hmm. Ooh, that's a good question. It's hard to say for sure, but it's possible. The court might be even more hesitant to interfere with prosecutorial decisions now than they were back in 1973. But on the flip side, there have also been some interesting developments in Section 1983 litigation, which deals with civil rights violations by government officials.
You're talking about, like, the type of claims that the Attica inmates were trying to make, right?
Exactly.
Now.
And there's this case, Nassar, the USA gymnastics doctor, that might have some interesting implications.
Oh, wow. I remember that case. Absolutely horrific. But what does a gymnastics scandal have to do with Attica? Help me connect the dots here.
Okay, so in the Nassar case, the Supreme Court said that the FBI's failure to properly investigate those reports about Nassar's abuse,
right,
could actually be considered a state-created danger.
Yeah. Violating the victim's constitutional rights.
Wait, so doing nothing, just failing to investigate, could be a violation of someone's rights?
It is a big deal.
That's a big deal.
And it makes you wonder, could the Attica inmates have made a similar argument that the state's failure to properly investigate and prosecute, you know, the alleged abuses at the prison created this dangerous situation, you know, that put them at risk of further harm?
That's a legal argument I would love to hear debated.
Right.
But it's all hypothetical at this point, right?
I mean,
we'll never know for sure how the courts would have ruled on that.
True, true. But that's what makes legal analysis so fascinating. We're always trying to figure out how these precedents might apply to new situations, especially as society changes and our understanding of the law evolves.
Well said. Well, this case really shows how legal precedents can have these ripple effects, you know, for decades, influencing how we think about accountability, justice, and the limits of power. But before we get too philosophical, let's do a quick recap of part two. What are the key takeaways so far? All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. We've been untangling the story of the Attica prison uprising and this landmark case, Inmates of Attica v. Rockefeller. We've talked about those horrific events, the inmates' bold legal strategy, that clever Attica two-step, and the case's lasting impact on things like, you know, prosecutorial discretion, class action lawsuits, that whole world.
And we've been kind of tiptoeing around another big legal beast. The Prison Litigation Reform Act.
Oh, yeah.
The PLRA.
The PLRA. It's time to dive into that.
Let's do it.
Okay, bring on the PLRA. But first, you know, for our listeners who might not have all the legal history memorized, remind us, when did this act come into play? How does it fit into the whole Attica saga?
So the PLRA, it was passed in 1996, more than two decades after the Attica uprising and all the legal battles that followed. But there's definitely a connection. You know, Inmates of Attica, it was part of this whole wave of prisoner lawsuits in the 60s and 70s, many of them, you know, focused on improving truly terrible prison conditions. And these lawsuits, I mean, they were often successful, but they also triggered a backlash.
So the PLRA was kind of a reaction to what some saw as like an overload of lawsuits from prisoners.
Exactly. There was this growing feeling that inmates were just flooding the courts, right?
Right.
With complaints about every little thing, like, you know, my food is cold or my cell is too hot.
Now, I'm not saying those things aren't important.
Right.
But I can see how that can lead to frustration.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if it's seen as, you know, people taking advantage of the legal system.
That's exactly the sentiment that fueled the PLRA. You know, Congress wanted to put the brakes on what they saw as, you know, excessive, maybe even unnecessary, you know, lawsuits coming from prisons. They also wanted to give more power back to state and local governments, right? To manage their own prison systems without so much federal court interference.
So it was Congress saying, enough is enough, time to rein in these prisoner lawsuits.
Pretty much. And they did that in a few key ways. First, they made it much, much harder for inmates to even file lawsuits in the first place.
Mm.
The PLRA has these strict exhaustion requirements, which means, you know, inmates, they have to go through all the internal grievance procedures within the prison system before they can even think about taking a case to federal court.
So no more running straight to the courthouse with every complaint. You gotta try to work it out within the prison system first.
Mm.
Makes sense.
It does. It does. The PLRA also put limits on, you know, the types of relief that inmates could ask for in a lawsuit. For example, it became a lot harder to get a court to order an injunction, you know, for something like a minor inconvenience, right?
Right.
Like the temperature of your cell. You'd have to prove, you know, serious ongoing violation of your constitutional rights.
So the bar was set much, much higher for inmates to get a court, you know, involved in prison matters.
Exactly. Exactly. And the PLRA also, it made it tougher for inmates to file class action lawsuits, you know, which, as we discussed earlier, were often used to challenge those systemic problems, right?
Right.
That affect a large number of prisoners. Hmm. Remember, that was part of the legal strategy in inmates of Attica,
yeah, right?
Right. Although the court never actually made a ruling on that class action issue.
Right. Even though the PLRA came later, you can kind of see how the legal landscape was already shifting in that direction, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Attica case, even indirectly, kind of contributed to an atmosphere where lawmakers felt they needed to put the brakes on prisoner lawsuits.
Absolutely. It's all connected. And here's where things get even more interesting. Some legal scholars, they actually argue that the PLRA, while maybe well-intentioned, right, it's actually made it tougher to expose and address real abuse happening inside prisons.
Wait, I thought the idea was to weed out those frivolous lawsuits and let prison officials do their jobs. How does that lead to more abuse? Help me understand that.
It's complicated, but here's the thinking. By making it so difficult for inmates to file lawsuits, right?
Right.
You're essentially silencing them. They might be less likely to report abuse or mistreatment because they know, right? It's going to be this uphill battle to get anyone to even listen, let alone take action.
Mm-hmm.
And that can create this climate where guards, other officials, they feel like they can get away with things.
Yeah. That's a scary thought. So it's a tough balance, right? You want to stop those frivolous lawsuits, but you don't want to create a system where real problems are just, you know, swept under the rug.
Exactly. And that debate, it's still going strong today. There's no easy answer. But what's clear is that, you know, inmates of Attica v. Rockefeller, even though it happened before the PLRA, right?
Yeah.
It played a part in shaping this whole complex legal landscape. It's a case that raises these fundamental questions about prosecutorial power, the limits of the courts, and that tension between security and justice within our prison system.
Wow, we've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive. From those harrowing events of the Attica uprising to the legal intricacies of prosecutorial discretion, the Attica two-step, and the lasting influence of this case on both legal precedent and legislation, and you like the PLRA, it's been quite a journey.
What's fascinating to me is how this one case from almost 50 years ago, it still has so much relevance today. It speaks to this ongoing struggle between accountability and power, between, you know, the pursuit of justice and those real world limitations of the legal system.
So true. And it leaves us with a lot to think about, right?
It does.
What does it really mean to achieve justice when courts are hesitant to second-guess prosecutors, even in cases where there are those serious allegations of wrongdoing? How do we strike that balance between, you know, the need for security in prisons, but also protecting the basic rights of inmates? And what role should the courts play in making sure our prisons are actually places of rehabilitation, not just punishment?
Those are questions we should all be grappling with. And Inmates of Attica v. Rockefeller gives us this powerful framework, right, for understanding these complex issues.
It really does. This case, it forces us to confront some tough truths about our justice system and the challenges of holding those in power accountable for their actions.
Well said. And on that note, I think it's time to wrap up this deep dive.
But before we go, I want to leave our listeners with one final thought.
Mm-hmm.
The Attica uprising and all the legal battles that came after, it was a product of this very specific time in our history, a time of massive social and political upheaval, you know, when people were really questioning the very foundation of our justice system.
Mm.
But those core issues of this case, they're still very much alive today, right?
Mm.
We're still wrestling with prosecutorial discretion, the power of the courts, and that ongoing struggle to hold those in authority accountable. The fight for justice, it's never truly over.
Cases like inmates of Attica v. Rockefeller, they remind us that we need to be vigilant, right?
Yeah.
In defending the rights of those who are most vulnerable, especially those within the walls of our prisons.
Well, thanks for joining us on this deep dive into a truly compelling and thought-provoking case. Remember, this conversation, it doesn't end here, right?
Keep exploring, keep asking those tough questions, and keep pushing for a more just and an equitable world.
Until next time.